Call the House Health Care Committee to order for Monday, the 30th of March, and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3230. Madam Administrator, what do we got here? Representative Gallegos, you want to join us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3230 defines community-based structured housing, specifies that community-based structured housing be registered with the Oregon Health Authority, directs the authority and the Department of Human Services to develop standard for registering the facilities, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, and Vice Chair Notes, and Vice Chair Hayden, and the rest of the committee. Thank you for having us today and hearing this bill.
Not allowed to talk to them until I get
No, okay. So this is a great little bill, and it was brought to us by a constituent of mine, so I want to thank my constituent. This bill, I'll be very brief. This bill aims to strengthen the community mental health system by providing a tool to standardize service delivery and protect a vulnerable population from abuse and neglect. This bill will put into place safeguards for both staff and residents of residential facilities and create a state registration for community-based structured housing facilities that service individuals suffering from mental illness and addiction issues. That's my statement briefly. It's a good bill. It should pass. Should you have any questions specifically for me, I mean, please don't hesitate to call me directly or contact me through my office. And with that, I'm going to introduce Justin Hopkins from the Addictions and Mental Health Department to speak on the mechanics of the bill. And I beg your pardon for leaving so abruptly, but I've got another bill to testify on in another room. So if I may, call Justin.
Who else do we have
to do that?
Mr. Chair, we have Bob Junduff and Kevin McChesney.
All right, great. Thank you very much.
Is that okay?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Justin Hopkins. I'm the Quality Management Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. The reason for my testimony today is to provide the committee with information regarding House Bill 3230. House Bill 3230 would amend the existing statute governing licensed residential treatment facilities and homes, as well as registered residential facilities, and those are found under ORS 443-400 as well as 443-480. So currently there are programs in the state that house and provide services to individuals where neither the setting nor the services provided meet the statutory definition of a residential treatment facility or home. Therefore, the Oregon Health Authority does not have the authority or the responsibility to license these programs. For example, if a program operates on a less than 24-hour basis, or they do not provide what is statutorily defined as a residential care or treatment, the program is not eligible to receive a license. And therefore, it's not subject to any of the safeguards or oversight that licensed residential treatment facilities or homes are provided with. There's currently a separate classification for registered facilities under Oregon Revised Statute 443-480. Currently, the Oregon Health Authority does not have the responsibility or the authority to register these facilities. The Department of Human Services has that responsibility. House Bill 3230 would give the Oregon Health Authority the responsibility to register those facilities, again, that don't meet the classification for a residential treatment facility. House Bill 3230 creates a definition for community-based structured housing. Programs meeting the definition of community-based structured housing would be required to register with the Oregon Health Authority. Examples of programs required to register with the Oregon Health Authority would be settings where services are provided on-site by the owner of the property or an employee or contractor of the owner. And these are congregate housing settings. These would not be for people living in their own apartments. These are congregate housing settings where individuals either have a shared bedroom or their own bedroom within a congregate setting. And the Oregon Health Authority is currently aware of numerous programs across Oregon that fit this mold without any type of oversight. House Bill 3230 also directs the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services to create standards for registered facilities. The standards for the facilities must address, at a minimum, the physical properties of the facility, food services and storage, medication administration, and staff training. By giving the Oregon Health Authority the statutory authority to register this category of facility, it would allow for the development of standards and review processes that could help to ensure the safety and well-being of individuals with mental illness or substance use disorders living in congregate housing settings. And through the development of a registry, House Bill 3233 would also enable the Oregon Health Authority to create an inventory of community-based structured housing programs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
This doesn't have a Ways and Means referral. Are you guys all prepared to do it in your existing budget? Is that the case? It might take some money.
Chair Greenlick, that's an excellent question, and it's still under review by our budget folks at OHA. So I'd be happy to get back to you with a response.
Be sure and let us know, because I would guess you're going to ask for positions or something.
Chair Greenlick, that's correct. Currently, it would be, since we're not sure where these programs exist across Oregon, we're not sure how many there are, we would need an additional FTE to manage this workload.
Which means Ways and Means. If you have anything different than that, I'll just assume if we go forward with this, it'll go to Ways and Means. Who's next?
Okay. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff, and I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 3230. This is a bill that unfortunately reminded me of my age. When I saw the bill, I was reminded that in 1989, I was on a work group that was formed for the purpose of looking at a problem. And the problem at that time was the fact that our community mental health system was not as robust as it is today, and we know how robust it is today. So we had some significant problems in terms of people coming out of state hospitals or living in communities and not having anywhere to live who had significant mental health problems. And so an industry sort of self-formed of folks who opened their homes to individuals to come live there and provided some food, a living room, and oftentimes assisted them with medications. We had received in the 1980s quite a few complaints about conditions in those facilities, but they, even though they were viewed as a direct placement option by the state hospital at that time, they were totally unregulated. The work group looked at that particular problem, and the sense was that there were not the resources to do a full licensing of those types of facilities, and in fact, licensing them formally might create standards that did not allow them to exist. The answer was a registration process. In theory, that these facilities would be registered and at least be on the radar screen for the state to understand where they were. And frankly, since that time, we haven't heard very much about these facilities. I don't know personally if DHS or OHA really has proceeded to collect or organize registrations or respond to complaints. It's really outside my understanding. However, they continue to be a source of housing and supports for people who don't have other options, and the idea that there would be some standards applied to these facilities, I think, is a welcome addition to the oversight that is provided for folks who are depending upon these types of residential options in our communities. So for that reason, we are supportive. Again, the model that we sort of shoot for these days is independent living options for people who can have their own apartments, and if they need services, to receive them in their, in those apartments. But that those housing, as you know, is difficult to come by, and these congregate care settings may be the best options that people have. Thank you, and I, of course, happy to answer any questions.
Let's get one more witness, then we'll have some questions.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Kevin McChesney, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Residential Providers Association. We have been collaborating with all the parties involved in this bill, and we also welcome the opportunity to really provide more oversight and regulation of what I would consider substandard housing placements for people with mental illness. We have asked AMH to look at some minor language changes to address what we really feel are that there's potentially language that could help stigmatize people with mental illness particularly. And I think the other thing that we're concerned about is for those providers who are legitimate and run above board businesses, that they not be subject to additional regulatory oversight that's not necessary. An example would be HUD housing, where currently it's not necessarily licensed, but HUD does come out every year and do an audit. They look at many of these, the regulatory areas that that Justin mentioned, and we don't want to add another layer, a redundant layer of that regulatory oversight. They're actually quite thorough in their audits. So that's really all we're asking for at this time, is some minor language changes. But otherwise, we're neutral on this bill and certainly don't oppose it.
Good questions,
Mr. Chair.
Hey, guy over here.
Yes. Chair. So the question I have, and I certainly understand the intent and why we're trying to get at the substandard net, but I'm trying to understand. So what's the effect? So there is now adequate housing that's provided, that's available for these people, that meets whatever the standards have been, or I'm just trying to understand the impact this will have if we start adding to that from a standpoint of available housing versus what we have today.
I wonder who's going to answer that.
Glad to. I think that there really isn't enough adequate housing. And I think there are single-room occupancy structures that really I would really consider almost tenements in their nature. And just by virtue of the fact that it's so difficult to find low-income housing, that we do place people there reluctantly, but we do.
Thank you.
Want to comment on that? You don't have to.
No.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. Well, some more language coming? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah.
An amendment? And if you have any more information for us? This is at the intersection. I was looking at Representative Kenny Geyer, because this is in the intersection between this committee and the Housing Committee, the Human Services and Housing Committee. But because it's the OHA, that's why it's here. But any insight you have in this problem?
Well, and we did pass a bill out of this committee recently, which is more housing. The start that we had done for $5 million in the past, and we're hoping to expand on that to partially meet this need. That part didn't deal with the regulation, but it just dealt with supply. So.
Okay. Thank you. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3230. We'll assume it's going to need to go to Ways and Means unless we hear otherwise. So if and when it comes back for a work session, we'll be adding that to it. I see Representative Nathanson's hiding in the back of the room, so I'll open up the public hearing on on House Bill 3396, is that right?
Yes.
3396, and ask Representative Nixon to join us. What's this bill, ma'am? What do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3396 combines the Primary Care Provider Loan Repayment Fund and the Primary Health Care Loan Forgiveness Fund into the Health Care Provider Incentive Fund.
Well, I bet nobody's had any interest in this bill, huh? Representative Nathanson, kick us off.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative for District 13. Hardly a peep. You're right. Hardly a peep.
Right.
Oregon allocates over $30 million each biennium to various programs to help recruit and retain health care providers, particularly for rural or underserved areas, and particularly in primary care. These programs use tax credits, loan repayment, loan forgiveness, insurance subsidies as incentives to students or providers to locate or stay in Oregon. Another $14.5 million comes to Oregon students and professionals from the federal government. Each of these programs has slightly different criteria, defining a rural or underserved area or listing which professions are included in primary care. We spend a lot of money, but we don't know which of these actually moves the dial, which is making a difference, or how much. Here's a quick summary of the financial incentives. Seven programs are using state dollars, and five programs are using federal dollars. For students, there are about 400 students getting help through state and federal programs, including loan forgiveness. For practitioners, about 2,400 are getting a tax credit. About 300 are benefiting from loan repayment, and 655 are getting an insurance subsidy. You don't add all those numbers up to get separate a number of how many different individuals, because one individual may get more than one incentive. For example, may be receiving a tax credit and an insurance subsidy, or perhaps a tax credit and still loan repayment, for example. It's in other words, the list isn't deduped. But suffice it to say, there are 400 students getting help, and something in the order of 2,400 plus, some part of 300 and some part of 655 practitioners getting help. It's unclear how effective the programs are compared to one another or even individually. We don't know which one of these is the best bang for the buck. And when there's scarce resources and when there's a need for recruiting and retaining healthcare professionals in rural areas or for primary care, you can understand there's a lot of pressure to spend more. But in a time when there isn't necessarily more money, how can we spend the money in the best way? The incentive programs are all developed with a central theme to bring healthcare to underserved and rural areas. With a shortage of professionals, it's particularly strong and noticeable in primary care. It's difficult to recruit and retain primary care and other professionals to practice in rural areas after years of costly medical school. They can make more money and pay off debts easier in a more densely populated urban area or under different conditions or with a different specialty. Help with the cost of education and tax credits have been used to encourage medical students and professionals to work in underserved communities. Incentive funds have been set up separately at different points in time. They go through different legislative policy committees and even through different ways and means subcommittees. Sometimes it's heard by an education committee and then goes to an education subcommittee of ways and means. Sometimes it goes through a committee such as this, through healthcare, and then goes through the human services subcommittee in ways and means. The proposals are reviewed in isolation. And indeed, the funding from year to year is reviewed in isolation without a broader perspective. Although they all aim toward reaching the same objective, there is no comprehensive review, and we still fund each separately. Each is based on a good idea and a guess about how much money might be useful, and without any regard, really, for putting the programs in context with each other. So here's the first challenge. Once the money is allocated to each program, there is no flexibility to respond to changing needs in the marketplace of students or the communities that need to provide the healthcare practitioners. You can't move money around from one program to another, even if it looks like we could sure use more here and a little less there for next year or the year after. This lack of flexibility, the lack of information on each program's effectiveness, and the narrow scope of focus create an institutional barrier. We just can't be nimble to be more effective. Access to healthcare providers has been recognized for some time as a critical problem in Oregon's healthcare system. We should take the first step in moving the dial. The bill you have before you is a small step toward addressing that lack of flexibility. The bill started out, frankly, as a lot bigger idea. It would have combined all of the incentives into one fund, one central fund. It will take more work, however, to figure that out, to combine tax credits, insurance subsidies, and loan repayment, for example. So this bill you have before you is simpler. It's looking at only a small portion of those. And while I acknowledge that this is rocking the boat, at least it's not overturning the boat and sinking it. The bill takes three of these incentives that are most closely related and combines them into a single healthcare provider incentive fund to be distributed by the Office of Rural Health, the Primary Care Provider Loan Repayment Fund, the Primary Healthcare Loan Forgiveness Program Fund, and Scholars for a Healthy Oregon Initiative. The Dash One Amendment adds two functions to the advisory committee to evaluate and report on the effectiveness and cost efficiency of various tax credits designed to recruit and retain healthcare practitioners, and two, to study and evaluate the feasibility of creating a retirement plan as a different kind of incentive to provide primary care in medically underserved areas. There are some other ideas also being tossed around for an amendment. One of them would allow students from all of Oregon's schools that provide healthcare education to compete for assistance from a program like Scholars for a Healthy Oregon Initiative. So that would include OHSU, the DO School, the DO College in Lebanon, and perhaps Pacific University. Another idea relates to who should review the programs and the funding levels. Who should sit at the table to recommend allocation of the fund based on each program's effectiveness and ability to leverage other sorts of funding? Who should be at that table? Is it just the Office of Rural Health? Does it include Oregon Center for Nursing and Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute, for example? Since I began working on this bill and the amendments, the Oregon Health Authority has provided me with some additional information very recently. What I get from that information are some ideas that you may want to take up also and add to this bill. For example, create a new centralized oversight body with legislative representation for all state-supported provider incentive programs to make funding prioritization recommendations each biennium. Number two, make immediate program design changes in the interest of affordability and equity. For example, tighten up the use of rural provider tax credits with time and income limits, and broaden the eligibility for Scholars for a Healthy Oregon Initiative. A third idea, require regular data collection and reporting by all programs on key elements. For example, the target audience, the funding level, the number of awards, the patients that are seen by program participants, retaining participants in underserved areas. Frankly, I can't believe the programs weren't already keeping this data anyway. I recognize you have a lot to think about here and that you may want to fine-tune the proposal. Move in some other pieces of the puzzle, expand or contract, or move around the parts. At the least, I think we shouldn't stand still. I hope you will take a first step with this idea. Thank you.
Nancy, we're struggling with, 2125, what to do with all these, and we'll take some testimony now, but I wonder whether we really shouldn't be thinking of maybe putting together a joint work group of your subcommittee of Ways and Means and the Senate committee and our committee to work this out in the interim and see if we can get some sense out of the whole. I mean, this is, as you know, it has a ton of moving parts to it. And I wonder whether we shouldn't just think about, if some of them are going out of sunset, put a brief sunset on it to give us a chance to work and try and figure out what to do with the loan. I think the loan repayment is one piece, but I think we also have to deal with the tax credit and with our relationship with some of the federal programs that are going on. I mean, I think we need to have a little discussion on this.
Yes.
As you know, that's what you're trying to move. Are there any other questions? Representative Nathanson? Representative Buehler?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlick. I appreciate your comments. It is, sitting on this committee for the first time, balancing all these different programs and seeing how they're allocated. A couple questions for you, if I may. I'm not familiar with the Oregon Center for Nursing and the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute. Can you explain a little bit about what those organizations are?
Mr. Chair and Representative Buehler, I don't want to presume to give the best explanation to you. I hope that there's a staff person here who can provide those for you.
Okay.
Those entities, however, have been collecting some data. They do some analysis. They do provide some recommendations. They write reports and make them available to Oregon Health Authority, for example. They haven't been in decision-making roles for funding levels, for example, but they have been participants in data collection, analysis, and recommending actions.
Okay. And quick follow-up, please. One of the main factors that their allocation recommendations are going to be based on is the effectiveness and cost efficiency of each program. I'm not sure that information exists. So would that be then studied in anticipation of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buehler, there is probably a way to dig back, to look back. It may not be complete data, but to see what has been effective. This is something that I have discussed also with Senator Bates, mm-hmm. who co-chairs the Human Services Subcommittee of Ways and Means. You could do, for example, a forward-looking 10 or 15-year longitudinal study to watch what happens over time. I don't believe that's the best thing to do because I think we more urgently need to reevaluate where we should spend these scarce resources. I would very much be interested in having some smart professionals help us figure out of the data that is available retrospectively, how can we figure out who received money from us incentives, where they were, and where they are now. I would think there would be a way to look back and see, get an indication of what's been working.
And just a quick comment. We've discussed this topic, as you can imagine, a couple times before, and that data is hard to come by, I agree, and I don't think we can wait for a longitudinal, blinded, multi-armed study. So one of the things we are thinking about is a gap analysis of the current status of health care providers in rural Oregon and underserved areas as another way to approach this issue.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to add just a brief follow-up. I thank Representative Buehler for his thoughts on this, for the work that you've been putting in looking at what might work, what direction we need to go. As I think about the chair's comments about there's a lot of moving parts, and we need to figure out even more broadly what's the best way to spend the money. I do, however, believe that there is value to taking a first step to combining at least some of the programs into a common fund that would then over time allow flexibility. For example, if you have, I'll just make up a number here, if you put $5 million into a fund that may be used on any one of three different programs, then you can figure out which one has been more effective or which one has policies that seem more appropriate to the future to recruit or retain in rural areas, for example. You can figure that out and have the flexibility then to move some of that money from year to year rather than wait for a strict time-limited process that happens once only every 2 years and where these funds are considered by different committees. It would allow for that broader oversight to at least start with a common incentive fund. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hayden.
Chair Greenlink, well, I'm a freshman here this year, and I appreciate that. I thought our job was to come here and rock the boat, so I appreciate that you're willing to do that. I think generally there's a lot of validity to the approach here, but how about taking it a little step further and aggregating all of the programs into one area and then start to look at those over time? Have you considered that approach rather than taking a portion of it, or is it just easier to take a portion of it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hayden, yes, in fact, my bill idea had started with putting all of those dozen programs into one common fund. The difficulty is that because there is an insurance subsidy program as well as a tax credit program, that's money that you don't know what you're spending until people claim it. So to provide a certain amount of funding, it would need to be open-ended authority, and an oversight group couldn't necessarily move money and say, let's spend less on tax credits and more on this loan forgiveness program, for example, because that's the way we want to go. Or Scholars for Healthy Oregon has such great promise. Let's put more there. The way that you can control how much is spent on certain sort of tax benefits requires different there's different mechanics to it, how you control that. And it was going to get awfully complicated to put it under one umbrella, at least to start with.
Just a quick follow-up. Yeah, thank you. I can understand that. I was more referring to just aggregating the programs separate from the funding so at least we can house all the programs in one area and start to understand the scope of them. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, what a great idea.
Representative, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to suspend this hearing. I'm going to leave it open. We've got some work sessions I'd like to do while I have a quorum. So if there are no problems, I'll leave this open and I'll open the work session on House Bill 2305. We have a dash six amendment to work on. Is that not right?
The dash six is the 2300. 2305 is the threes.
I just opened 2300.
Okay.
2305 is what you just opened.
Did I?
Yes.
I'll close 2305.
There we go.
And open 2300 because I want to deal with the dash six amendment. And I've asked Representative Bueller to work us through the amendment in the bill in its high points.
Yes, you would like a summary of those?
Basically,
pardon me?
Summary of the amendment.
The amendment and also the highlights of the bill.
Okay. So, as you know, we convened a work group chaired by Representative Nose and myself, and we had two sessions with abundance of input and good thought in between. And there's a few of the amendments I'd like to highlight that that changed the proposal, as we heard in our previous public hearing. The first is that the medication or the device would have to have already gone through a phase one completion study. The second is that we define the practitioner as either a medical doctor or a doctor of osteopathy. Another change, another amendment, is we restricted the age to 15 years and older. We defined terminal as being within 12 months of death. The cost could be, the patient could be charged no more than the cost of administration and manufacturing of the experimental device or drug. Insurance would have to be notified that the patient is receiving this treatment, and there is clear waiving of liability for the manufacturer and the provider. And that's just a highlight of the Dash 6 amendments.
Great. Can I have a motion?
Chair Greenlick, I'd like to move to adopt the Dash 6 amendments dated 3/25/15.
Representative Bueller moves we adopt the Dash 6 amendments dated 3/25/15 to House Bill 2300. Is there any discussion on the amendments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
If I remember right, some of the testimony was about concern that some of this might affect the way the drugs are rated in the larger picture. I guess actually that was an individual discussion then. Does this address that issue?
I think the issue is addressed by the fact that the side effects need to be reported. Am I remembering this correctly? The side effects would need to be reported if a drug was in phase 2 trials, even though it wasn't a part of the
trial. Yeah, the thought is probably that the side effects will be reported, but since it's not part of a registered clinical trial with, you know, two arms of treatment, that it wouldn't have much, if any, effect on the approval process, because it's not a scientific method.
Thank you. That's a better reframe of what I was trying to get at.
And we did discuss that issue.
Any other discussion? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate
the amendment.
Representative Bueller's work on this and the amendment and everything and getting some of the statute clarified. I know there have been concerns on the bill, and I'll wait and address those when we get to the bill, but I think a lot of stuff was cleaned up and taken care of.
Any objection to the amendments? The amendments are in the bill. We have a motion on the main bill now, as amended.
Chair Greenlick, I move House Bill 2300 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bueller moves House Bill 2300 as amended with the Dash 6 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know there are concerns on House Bill 2300 and its effect with the Death with Dignity Act and everything, and LC had an opinion basically saying that it wouldn't affect that. Basically, everything we're doing is only for House Bill 2300. So, and there is an LC opinion out there for that as well. So if members of the committee would like that, and I'll probably give it to the committee administrator so we can have that posted up with the bill as well.
It has no effects whatsoever on death for dignity. That's good that we have that information. Is there any other discussion on the bill? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Representative Klein?
Aye.
Representative Kennemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Bueller and Representative Nose carry the bill on the floor. Is that?
Sure.
Yeah. Close the work session on House Bill 2300. And now I'm going to get it right. Open a work session on House Bill 2305. Madam Administrator, what have we got here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2305 had a public hearing on February 13th. You'll recall this has to do with the PolySomTech program. It allows individuals who have completed the program that combines education and training in the program can apply for the PolySomTech license. The Dash 3 amendments have been worked on, and they clarify that an individual that has met the required education and training and who has obtained and maintained the nationally recognized credential meets the prerequisites for licensure by the board. We have a minimal impact on the bill and no revenue impact on the bill, Mr. Chair.
Can I have a motion on the amendment, please?
Chair Greenlick, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendment dated 3/19/15.
Representative Hayden Moves to adopt the dash three amendments dated 3/19/15 to House Bill 2305. Any discussion on the amendment? Any objection? So moved. We have a motion on the main bill.
Chair Dwayne, I move House Bill 2305 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves House Bill 2305 to the floor as amended with the dash three amendments. Is there any discussion on the bill? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Buick?
Yes.
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenland?
Aye. Motion carries. Is there a volunteer to carry this? Representative Lively, would you like to volunteer?
Certainly I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Close the work session on House Bill 2305. Open the work session on House Bill 2642, which incidentally not only has an amendment, but it's going to need a referral to Ways and Means. What do we have here, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 4 amendment basically replaces the original bill, so I'll give you the highlight of that. This clarifies the definition of non-ablative to mean an action that does not result in the wounding of the skin, requires annual renewal of the CAE licensure certificate, clarifies the agreement between the certified advanced esthetician and healthcare professional, requires disclosure of existence of the professional liability. It creates a nine-member board of the certified laser estheticians within the health licensing office. Members are appointed by the governor. It also defines the advanced non-ablative aesthetics procedure.
Easy
to use. I know. I'm sorry. I get really good with it.
I thought we had an amendment that didn't require a board. Holly, can we? Can you join us for a minute? Did I misremember that?
No, I think I might have.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlink, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Holly Mercer. I'm the Director of the Health Licensing Office. I believe, Chair Greenlink, that we talked about changing the music therapy board to a program. Mm-hmm. This board, however, is a sizable board with a sizable number of estheticians that would be involved. So it merits a board.
And you feel comfortable with the
state
it's in
now? Sir.
Good.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I do want to add that we do have a fiscal impact on the bill, which should be up on OLIS, and there's no revenue impact.
And that's why it's going to Ways and Means.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Can I have a motion on the amendment, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move to adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated March 26, 2015.
Representative Nose moves the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2642, dated 3/26. Is that right?
Yes.
15. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any objection? Amendments in the bill. We have a motion on the main bill.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2642 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Nose moves that we moved House Bill 2642 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Klem?
Aye.
Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nelson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2642 is on its way to Ways and Means, and the work session on House Bill 2642 is closed. We'll get back to the hearing. We'll call the next panel on House Bill, what is that, 2396?
33.
Pardon me?
3396.
I'm sorry, House Bill 3396.
Scott Ekblad.
My trifocals are falling.
I know. Doug Barber.
You have a panel?
I'm not sure. And Caleb Hayes. And then after that, there's one more. I was going to split them off.
Show first. Any order?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs Hayden and Nose, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health. There has been quite a bit of discussion, and there was during the 2013 legislative session regarding the various healthcare workforce incentive programs in the state, and a work group was formed during the interim to compare their effectiveness and to see how they could be better aligned. At the same time, the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Committee was tasked by the Oregon Health Policy Board to do essentially the same thing. The consensus of both groups was that we cannot make informed decisions without better data and, more importantly, ongoing analysis and evaluation of these programs to determine whether they need to be changed and how. One idea that got a bit of traction
was... So much for another work group.
One idea that got a bit of traction was that of combining the funds of similar programs. That would enable the flexibility to shift monies from one to the other based on current need, and House Bill 3396 would combine the funds of three different programs, as you heard earlier, Loan Repayment, Loan Forgiveness, and OHSU's Scholars for Healthy Oregon Initiative. Funding for these programs currently go to three different entities, although the Oregon Office of Rural Health is involved in the administration, either entirely or in part, of all three. House Bill 3396 would also send the funds for all three of these programs directly to the Oregon Office of Rural Health. This bill is also in alignment with general agreement among the interim work group participants in that it relies on the advisory oversight of healthcare workforce experts, including the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute and the Oregon Center for Nursing. This advisory group would determine how to allocate the monies in the newly created healthcare provider incentive fund among the three programs named. Senate Bill 757, being heard by the Senate Healthcare Committee later today, would provide resources to those two entities for comprehensive data collection, as well as analysis and evaluation of all healthcare workforce incentive programs in the state in which the state invests dollars. It is my opinion that one of the three programs affected by this bill is not as good a fit as the other two, and that's OHSU Scholars for Healthy Oregon. It's a program that is closely tied to the admissions process at OHSU schools, and the Oregon Office of Rural Health is really only tangentially involved with the academic mission of OHSU, and we would simply contract back with the provost's office to administer the program as it is currently. So therefore, I recommend that Scholars for Healthy Oregon be removed from this bill, or if not, that the language being struck saying that no one can be contracted to run the program be reinstated. And there's one other piece of information which I believe the committee should be, of which I think the committee should be aware. Two of the affected programs, Loan Forgiveness and Scholars for Healthy Oregon, are currently in OHSU's budget. The third, Loan Repayment, is not funded in any budget. So funding for that program went to the Oregon Health Authority in the current biennium. However, OHA did not request continuation funding for that for the upcoming biennium. So thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Scott. Next, please. Sure. Instantly, I agree with you on the Scholars for Healthy Oregon. I don't think it fits in the same. I think it's a very distinct program and ought to be looked at independently. I'll put an amendment forward in case we move this bill.
Great. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Association, Oregon Rural Health Association. In partial support of the bill, as Scott mentioned, there is some value to trying to combining the loan forgiveness and loan repayment programs. It's very difficult for Ways and Means to project what the demand is going to be for those programs two and a half years ahead. That's particularly true for a newer program like the Loan Forgiveness Program. I think they've done a really good job. This biennium, it looks like we're going to come in just about on target. But, you know, what would be helpful is really just on the margins. You know, it might be $100,000 one way or the other that if there's extra demand on the loan forgiveness side and some great applicants, that money could be moved over there. Likewise, if the money, if there wasn't the demand on the loan forgiveness side, some of that money could be moved over to loan repayment. That's where I think the value is in this program. As Scott mentioned and the chair, I agree that Scholars for a Healthy Oregon is a different type of program. It's really an admissions program and doesn't belong in the same pot. And also, we do face this challenge, as Scott mentioned, about funding for loan repayment. I mean, the value here is if funds from loan forgiveness and loan repayment are combined. Currently, loan forgiveness is in the governor's budget. Loan repayment is not. So that's a $4 million gap that we hope to close before the end of the session. We'll be working diligently on that, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to combine programs that don't have any money in them. So we need to get that money there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Caleb Hayes. I'm here on behalf of the College of Osteopathic Medicine of the Pacific Northwest, the DO School in Lebanon. Here in support of 3396, we appreciate Representative Nathanson's work to get the best bang for the buck for the taxpayer on these incentive programs. It's really important that we get good statewide policy on these matters, and we appreciate the aim of this bill in doing that. In particular, we also appreciate the fact that the Scholars for a Healthy Oregon Initiative is in the bill to have its funds combined with the other programs, but also she has been willing to entertain, Representative Nathanson has been willing to entertain an amendment that would open up the program to allow all of the qualified students in Oregon to compete for the funds in that program. And just as in by putting all the funds together in one area to analyze and ensure that we're getting the best bang for the buck for the taxpayers' good statewide policy, we believe that taking a holistic look at all of the Oregonian students that could help alleviate our workforce shortage together in the same pool will allow us to get the best candidates to go out to rural Oregon or underserved Oregon to serve our communities. And so that's why we appreciate her entertaining that amendment, and we hope that we'll be able to get that done this session, whether it be through this bill or another one. With that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Any questions of the panel? Thank you very much. We have one more.
Mr. Chair.
You call the next witness, please.
Jonathan Eames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jonathan Eames, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Primary Care Association. I'll speak quickly and be brief. We're here actually to testify in support of the Dash 1 amendments as well. The Oregon Primary Care Association, which serves medically underserved in rural areas, actually we did some touring over the course of the interim, and one of the common themes that we heard throughout a number of rural areas is that when we ask folks, what do you need to be able to stay here in this area? What is it that we can do from we go with legislators? What can we do to help you? And what consistently, obviously, there's a lot of programs out there to look at. But what they said is, you know, what would be really nice, and this is often from even younger healthcare providers, is if we had some sort of retirement plan that we could access. Is there something that we could do to access a 401k or something which ties us here? And obviously, it would be a vesting period of some sort. But we hear all the time that we need to continue to save. We need to continue to do that. And what the option is for them is, if their spouse doesn't have a job in that underserved or rural community, it becomes harder for them to save. So if there's something that we could do to encourage that and for them as an added retention incentive, then that's where that idea came up of. And we talked with Representative Nathanson, and she agreed, as you can see in the Dash 1 amendments, that this would be something that we could look at. Now, we're not asking specifically to be prescriptive. We're not saying, hey, you should do this. They should have access to PERS or whatever it may be. That's not the intent of what it's. It's for something to look at when you're evaluating the effectiveness of programs to say, hey, is there something else, another state that's doing this that maybe we could use as an option? So that was the intent of the Dash 1 amendments, and we think it's a really good idea. So,
Jonathan, I've seen a proposal for something called the Oregon Retirement Security Program.
Mm-hmm.
Would that fit the needs of the...
That's it, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm not sure, but we'll definitely look into that. It's just something more, you know, and it's something they're putting money into. And if there was some sort of match or something, or even that their employer could be able to put into to keep them tied to that community. We toured the Asher Community Clinic in Fossil, Oregon. They're the only clinic in a huge swath in that area, healthcare clinic. And the one PA that was there, she said, gosh, if you could do something on a 401k, we want to stay here. But, you know, Portland's only an hour and a half down the way or 2 hours down the way, and my spouse hasn't found a job yet here in Fossil, Oregon. So completely understood her plight, and we met with the medical director after that, and he said, yeah, we have a terrible time. We'd love to be able to provide that. So that was the suggestion.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Close the work session on, I mean, the public hearing on House Bill 2396. 3396. There you go. Got it right that time. Close that and open a public hearing on House Bill 3245. Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 3245 adds underserved community as medically underserved communities to the tax credit for the rural health care providers, establishes criteria for the providers to receive the tax credit, authorizes the Office of Rural Health to designate medically underserved area, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2016.
And this has a subsequent to revenue?
It does, Mr. Chair.
We have some witnesses.
We have Scott Ekblad and Doug Barber.
They look familiar.
Yeah.
Representative Nathanson, do you have an opinion on this one?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs Hayden and Nose, members of the committee. I'm Scott Ekblad, the Director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health. As I mentioned, just recently, there's been quite a bit of discussion about workforce incentive programs. They usually start with the rural practitioner's tax credit. Proposed changes to the program have been numerous and wide-ranging. In 2013, the program sunset was extended for 2 years, and a work group was formed during the interim to take a look at all the provider incentive programs utilized in the state to compare their effectiveness and to see if they could be better aligned. And also, as I mentioned earlier, at the same time, the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Committee was tasked by the Oregon Health Policy Board to do essentially the same thing. The consensus of both groups was that we cannot make informed decisions without better data and, more importantly, ongoing analysis and evaluation. The Rural Practitioners Tax Credit Program began with the tax year 1990. It's been added to and revised over the years. Different professions were added at different times and have different eligibility criteria. For physicians, much depends on the hospitals at which they have admitting privileges. Attempts to outline eligibility criteria for these various practitioners quickly become very detailed and confusing. House Bill 3245 and the Dash 1 amendments would simplify those criteria. It makes eligibility the same for all allowed professionals. It also narrows eligibility to those located in or serving underserved communities, and expands the credit to include urban practitioners. Determining whether or not a practitioner is located in an underserved community or is seeing an underserved population is much more difficult than it sounds, and therefore this bill also allows the Oregon Office of Rural Health to convene an advisory group to determine underservice eligibility criteria specific to each of the participating professions. The reason for that is that the underservice designations that currently exist are restricted to primary care. We also have podiatrists, dentists in the tax credit program currently. You can't really use a primary care underservice designation for an optometrist or a dentist, really. I've attempted to estimate the number of people who would be eligible for this tax credit if the bill became law. I have to emphasize that this is an estimate because the proposed advisory group would ultimately determine who is eligible. Until then, our best guess is based on federal health professional shortage area designations. The number of practitioners we currently have eligible for the tax credit is 2,192. The number eligible with the passage of this bill is 7,281.
7,000. A slight increase.
It's a bit of an increase. Many urban practitioners would become newly eligible, and some rural practitioners would become ineligible. However, that number is only about 100. If you look at the map of health professional shortage areas, almost the entirety of rural Oregon is considered medically underserved. If you look at the Portland metro area, there isn't a whole lot of geographic health professional shortage areas in the Portland metro area, but there are health professional shortage area facilities. In other words, facilities that are set up specifically to see a medically underserved population. And we've written the bill so that people practicing at those facilities would also be eligible for the tax credit. So with that, I thank you for the opportunity to speak. And as always, I'm happy to answer questions.
Scott, I have a question about a different bill that's in this. We had a bill on occupational therapists. And I've since heard that that bill would put them in a federal program rather than a state program. Do you know anything about that?
Chair Greenlick, I'm not quite sure.
I wasn't either.
What that's about.
Okay. Would you take a look at that bill for us?
Sure.
And find out if I thought it was, it allowed them to come into the tax, the state tax deferral program, but
it's a loan repayment program. They wanted to be part of the loan repayment program.
Yeah, but was that a federal program or a state program? Is the question? That's the.
I don't know off the top of my head.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Rural Health Association. Again, there is a portion of this bill that I think is right on point, and that is the administrative simplification. Scott alluded to it. If you look at the bill itself, you will see some of the oddities of eligibility based on when these different professions came in. It makes sense to streamline that. To make eligibility more consistent across the board. The downside is it would be a considerable expansion of the program. Even if it was still just restricted to rural Oregon, it would have be a considerable expansion. If you add urban, it's quite a bit, as Scott mentioned. I mean, I'm okay with that if you're okay with that, but it's a lot of money. But I do think that the bill tries to get at this issue of trying to be a little more consistent about the eligibility across the programs, and I think that is a valuable goal. So with that, I will conclude. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Hayden?
Chair Greenlee. Thank you for the bill and the concept of it. I do have a question as you're addressing or giving authority to address the ratios. Do you have any example of what those might be and how that may or may not be applicable in areas where the population doesn't meet those ratios? Would it be one across the state ratio or would it be geographically by county ratio?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, I'm not quite sure what you mean by ratio and what context.
Well, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that what we're proposing is the people that take advantage of this tax credit currently under some of the regulations, if they see one Medicaid patient a year, they qualify. So I think we're talking about saying, okay, for example, you've got to see 35% of your practice has to be Medicaid patients in order to qualify, putting some parameters around who could qualify. And so I wanted you to try, if that is correct, I wanted you to try and address how would that be regulated and how would that be tied to the populations, particularly in rural Oregon, that 35% may not be achievable or may be too little or something like that.
Right. Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, thanks for that clarification. The way the program currently operates, and this came into being during the 2013 session, is that when applying for the tax credit, the provider must attest to keeping their practice open to the same amount of Medicare and Medicaid as exists in the county in which they practice, or 15% Medicaid, 20% Medicare, or the other way around, whichever is lower. And so it's a minimum of 15 and 20%. Does that answer your question?
So is this proposing changing that?
No.
Did I hear most of the practices in rural Oregon are open to Medicaid now?
You have some. Chair Greenlick, as far as I know, yes. Yeah, the vast majority.
I heard something like that. I'd be interested to know that. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3245. We've wasted 40 minutes of good time. We need more heavier agenda.
We saved it.
We're adjourned.
Wow. Jeez. Oh my God, an hour.
You guys are good.
Oh my God, an hour.
You guys are good.